Blog Talk Radio.
Disappointments, challenges, and success. We will be exploring these topics and more on Blog Talk Radio's How to Be Comfortable in Your Own Shoes. Welcome, everyone. I'm Lauren Leibowitz. It's Thursday, June 10th, and once again, we are coming to you live from Los Angeles, as I do every Thursday at 3 p.m. Pacific Time. Thank you so much for joining us. And since summer is in the hood, in the neighborhood, that is, we've decided to officially open the swimming pool. So even if you have your swimming trunks on, it's a hot one here, so feel free to take a little dip in our pool. And our cabana boy, Juan, is standing by for your every whim. And we love to hear from you. So please call in to listen live or ask questions at 347-857-2710. Those special 10 numbers are 347-857-2710. We are here live until 4 o'clock p.m. Pacific time. So I have a question for all of you. Have you ever thought about playing tennis and using it as a platform for self-discovery? Interesting, huh? Well, my two guests today are going to be sharing the airwaves and their expertise just on that subject. Our second guest will be here a little bit later in the show. So let's get ready to get on the tennis court with my first guest, who provides a unique teaching technique he coins practicing life through tennis. He's been a tennis coach for over 30 years and meets with clients for sessions intended to improve their tennis game and to address issues that may affect them on and off the court, like anxiety, phobias, anger, and much, much more. Please give it up for Zach Kleiman. Hello, Zach.
Are you letting me on?
You're on now.
Oh, you muted me.
I did. You were muted. How did it feel to be muted?
It was a little frustrating. Like, Lauren, where are you?
Right, you're drowning and no one can hear you.
Yes.
But now I
feel much better.
You feel much better. Well, good. Well, I'm happy you feel much better. Welcome to the airwaves.
Thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure. You know, I wanted to actually...
I had a student this morning. I was listening to your opening. I had a student this morning. She said, and I thought it was just about the tennis. her hand was on her head and pulling her ear out of the side of her hair and going, I thought I was just coming here to hit tennis balls. I didn't want to learn that I rush things. I didn't want to learn that I was looking into the future.
Wow. So was this her first session with you?
No, it's been about almost, I think, over 2 years.
That's brilliant. I'm not laughing at her. I'm just laughing at the experience. That's beautiful. Well, your work is done. She got it.
I said, that's the radio show this afternoon. I thought I was going to hit tennis balls.
Yeah, well, I've often shared what you do with my friends, and the most common response I get is, well, I don't play tennis, or I don't have a tennis racket, or it's been so long since I've played tennis. I said, that doesn't matter.
Yeah, if you really are going to play tennis, you might need a tennis racket. But
right, but I think it's interesting how people perceive what you do, that tennis, you have to know how to play. Or you even, I mean, you have tennis rackets for people to borrow.
Yes, always.
Always.
I mean, we do it through the process of tennis, but you don't. You will learn how to play tennis anyway, as a byproduct of learning about yourself.
Exactly. It's what do they call that when you go to the cosmetic counter? It's a you buy a gift and you get one free. It's kind of the same thing.
Oh, you buy something, you get the gift.
Yeah, but there's a funky name for it. I don't know what it is. Yeah,
it's called salesmanship.
No,
it's called promotion.
It's a promotion because you know how women are. They oh wow, look at that great bag. Or those, I can put my cosmetics in that. Oh, but you have to buy X amount of money. You know, spend X amount of money at the cosmetic counter, and then you get the freebie. So, but learning to play tennis while dealing with whatever issues you may have is just a lovely gift that you get.
Well, the tennis isn't really, you're not really learning how to play tennis. You're really learning about yourself while and through hitting a tennis ball.
Yes.
And that is the work. That if I am scared, I will hit the tennis ball with that filter of fear between me and the ball. If I'm scared of getting 5 in a row over the net and in, there's a good chance the net will suddenly get in the way right after that 4th shot so that I don't get my 5th.
So what's the most common, maybe, for those people that are aware of coming to you for a specific reason, what is the most common reason people come to you?
It seems to come in waves. Perfectionism is a big one.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
But the perfectionism it often causes procrastination. So procrastination is pretty close to the perfection.
Well, are they those two married in some way?
I think they're interwoven. When Davis joins us, she will have more expertise on that, but my experience of these many years of doing this is that they are very, very intimately connected. That when somebody is desirous of perfection, it's really hard to move. It's really hard to take a step because they want every step to be perfect.
Right.
I was playing doubles the other day, and my partner was trying to hit a winner off of the particular opponent's serve, and I turned to her and said that, you know, you've played against this guy many times. How often have you hit a winner off his serve? And she said, never. I'm still trying. And I said, I cannot hit winners off his serve. It's very rare. Usually it happens when I mishit the ball and nobody knows where it's going. And I have to, his serve is really, really tough, and I have to humble myself. And I asked her to humble herself and said, will you just get the return serve in, and then we'll deal with winners later. And it changed her, the pressure on her own body. Her eyes softened. She could now see the ball. She wasn't in the future, and she was moving toward the ball. She could really see it better.
I just had a thought. Why would it seems that by winning the point off of somebody's serve that you want to get through something very quickly? Why wouldn't you want to play that little conversation out? What was her hurry?
Well, when I asked that superb question,
thank
Lauren.
You. I'm all grown up now. I have superb questions.
She did say she wants to get it over with. She wants to win. That winning is more important than playing, which I think she's slowly learning that could be trouble. And my sense is it's she really doesn't like tennis. She's just using tennis to play out some needs, like dominance and proving.
Well, has that worked for her in the past?
No.
So she's going to do it until she gets it right.
I think that's her. She would rather be right than vulnerable.
Yeah, vulnerable is pretty scary.
Well, that means that I'd have to play.
Or be involved.
Yes.
You know. Yeah. Yeah, that's very interesting.
And there, so perfection, procrastination are a very common one. The future, wanting to know what the future will bring, which is fear of being present,
mm-hmm.
is another big self-doubt, big one. Second-guessing, people who second-guess themselves.
Well, I don't know, and I think this can relate to the kind of work you did. You do. I was watching the third game of the NBA Finals. The first Boston game.
Okay.
And it was, I don't know, maybe 3 minutes in the fourth quarter, and they were talking about the play of Derek Fisher. You know, he's one of the older members on the team, and it seems as if other bench players were tentative in shooting because of where the score was with 3 minutes to go. Even though that's a lot of time left in a game, but it was a very close score. The Lakers had led by almost maybe 20 points, and that was dwindled down. But the comment was made by one of the sports commentators that Derek Fisher had no fear about shooting. He just did it. He ran down the court with three big Celtic players after him and made a basket. And so you can see if you don't have the fear, how at times that could be a very empowering experience. And you just figure
well,
out.
But
what
I'm not. I didn't read the interviews afterward. Did he say he had no fear, or is
no,
it just the sports commentator?
No, it wasn't that he personally said it, but you could see it in the play that some of the bench players were very tentative in their shot, as if they wanted to make it right because their skill depended on a basket, which would give the Lakers a better lead so that Boston couldn't come back and win and take the game from them. But in just watching Derek Fisher's play and his performance, he didn't come from a fear-based place. He played his game. He saw it in the moment, hesitated, whatever he needed to do. There was no fear involved. That's how I don't know what his thoughts about it were.
Right. I mean, that would because he might come back and say, "Of course, I was scared."
True.
But it's the way he deals with it, not that he is scared or isn't scared.
Exactly. But aren't we all? We all face a fear of some sort. But just like you said, it's how we deal with that that is the difference.
Yes.
How do you deal with fear?
Good.
Did I get a second good question?
Yeah. This is good for you today.
Yeah, it is good.
Well, I could answer how do I deal with it for other people, but I think you asked for myself.
That's interesting. That's a two-parter. So why don't you just take what you first said, how do you deal with it with others, and then if you could give your own.
Well, it would probably be close to the same. I look at it. Usually it's fear of what's going to happen. If I take that basketball and drive down the center of the court, so many things could happen. And I first work with observing the fear, what the fears could be. Oh, I'm going to trip. The ball will slip out of my hand. It'll be stolen. and tennis, the ball will I'll miss it. I won't hit the strings. It'll hit the frame. It won't go over the net. It'll go over the net, but it'll go out. And do my best to help somebody see all the storylines of failure, which is usually what they're scared of. The second part is what the success. You know, what happens if they do hit the ball over the net and get it in? They're afraid that it'll come back. They're afraid that they'll have to engage. They're afraid that it won't be a winner. Some people on the fewer side are afraid that they will hit the winner. They will be better than their friend across the way, and they will then have to leave their friend and go play with better players. So sort of like everything leads to loneliness.
So you might as well be the loser, and then you at least have your friends.
Yes. Or at least try to keep things equal. So you diminish yourself, possibly, in order to maintain friendships. Or tennis partners. Or comfortable tennis partners.
That's very interesting.
So, and then once it's looked at, once the fears are looked at, then start to laugh at them, dissolve them, put them on the bench, get them out of the way. You could always invite them back. Recognize that some of those fears helped my attention. Some fears heighten the adrenaline, heighten the neurons and ignite the synapses in the brain, dilate the pupils. So some fears and some levels of fear are very helpful for performance.
So then how do you talk to yourself so that you're able, once you've gone through the possibility of these fears, the variety, how do you talk to yourself so that you can move forward?
You just sort of, the answer's right in there. As you start to talk, you sift through pieces of them and go, oh, this one can help me. This one isn't helping me. I'm afraid the ball's going to go out, maybe not helping me. I'm afraid I might hit the frame, might help me because it keeps my attention on something closer to the hit. Closer to the immediacy of what's going on. Oh, we're playing tennis.
And all of this takes place within nanoseconds.
I was just going to say the same thing. It all takes place really quickly.
Really quickly. Unless you can take your time, the moment, let's say if you're about to serve, and your serves haven't been going in, you've been double faulting, and you want to get yourself out of that habit of double faulting, that you can take a moment to have this rapid dialogue with yourself and reignite something within you to try something different.
Yes, and that reignition is possibly just taking a breath, pretty simplistic, jumping up and down so you can feel your body. Slap your thigh so, again, you can feel your body, and the thigh being close to the center of our body or where our gravity sort of sits. And then remind yourself to go forward. And we do have to desensitize ourselves to that fear. Remembering that, okay, I'm not going to die from this. Let me hit the ball. Let me go forward. Let me drive through the center of the key and put the ball up for a layup.
And, of course, the more times you experience a reoccurring fear, the easier it becomes because it's familiar.
And it says it's practiced. And that practice might lead to more faith and more trust and more belief in oneself and one's abilities, or help us learn our limits and learn how to tell our doubles partner, why don't you get that one?
Right. Wow, what an interesting thing to know that you find that you are limited or maybe that's not your expertise.
Or my shoulder hurts today. I don't think I should be the one hitting all the overheads. So if they're high enough and we have a little time, why don't you take them? Because today's not my day.
Well, how often does that dialogue between, if you're playing doubles, does that dialogue occur between people?
I'd say definitely before, if you're playing competitively, definitely before the match, if you've played together before. And if you haven't played together, hopefully it happens before the match or quickly in at the beginning of the match when somebody misses a shot and they tell their partner, oh, I forgot to tell you, my hamstring is broken.
Yeah. Right. I always like that. You can always tell when people don't talk together when someone returns a shot and it's right down the middle. And it, what do they call that, the husband shot?
The husband shot? Never heard that.
Somebody called her the husband and wife shot because, honey, you were supposed to get, you know, you were supposed to get that. No, honey, you were supposed to get that. There's a sense of, oh, I'm not sure. Whose shot was that?
I'm going to have to use that someday.
Please, feel free. But the opponents tend to look like
it was yours.
Yeah, what do you mean it was mine? And it just goes in that same place.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But people aren't aware. It was interesting. I was playing doubles the other day, and the four people that usually play, one of them hasn't been available to play, so there was a substitute. So it was this guy, and we were warming up, and I realized that I hit a few warm-up shots to his backhand, but and he was a right-handed player, instead of using his backhand, he quickly switched his racket from his right to his left hand. So he always hit a forehand. I thought that was interesting. I don't think I've ever seen that before.
And?
I don't know. It was just because it was very interesting how, I think we've talked about this, how we leak out. We as people, you think, well, you'll never know my deep, dark secrets. I'm going to hide it all. But we can tell a lot about a person by many subtleties, how they stand, their language, their hand gestures, how they play tennis, how far up to the net do they come, how far behind the baseline do they stand.
So when you realized that you were not going to be able to hit to this guy's backhand because he didn't have one.
He didn't have one. I thought, well,
what
is his
weakness?
Huh? What is his weakness? That was my question.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn?
And how long did it take?
I'm still learning. It's a work in progress. I don't know. I found him to be kind of a batting cage? Because he would just hit it back. It was just a quick
switch. A backboard?
Like a backboard, right. But I did learn that if I hit the shot at his feet, right at his feet, he didn't move very well.
You know, so he didn't move away from the ball very
right.
well.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And what if he was standing out of bounds?
He did. He was always off. You know, that's just my perspective. He didn't stand in a traditional position behind the baseline. He came in to no man's land. And he was just off center a little bit. But I think that was an indication of how he played. He played a little off, not in a bad way, but his style was a little bit more unique than most.
And did he and his partner beat you?
Well, yes, but it was a grueling match because we were down 2-5 and we came back and lost, 8-10.
You were up 2-5?
Yeah, we were up 2-5. Right, we came back.
And what did they change? Did he move his position or did...
No, I think my partner and I perhaps lost because I realized the number of errors that I made because my partner whispered to me, he says, if I hit to this one particular partner, the other partner that did have a backhand, his response was usually a lob, and that was all he did. And so my partner would say, can't he do anything else? It's so boring. Where's the fun? It's always a lob. It's the same type of play, and he usually stands back at the baseline if he's not receiving. So I think we lost more than they won.
After you were winning. After you were up 5-2.
I think I made some shots that were like I wasn't present.
So once you were up 5-2.
No, we were down. We were down. It was 2-5.
Oh, and then you were down 2-5.
Right. We were down 2-5. We came back 5-5. Then it was 6-5.
And then it went back and forth.
Yep. So I thought we came back. We regrouped. We refocused. And I know I took more chances up at the net.
So once you were about to lose, something changed.
Right. But that's where I like to be. I love to climb my way out of a hole.
So, I was going to bring it back to perfection and procrastination. When you were down 5-2, you were hesitant. You didn't have a goal or a purpose, and then you were down 5-2, about to lose, and then you were willing to let go more, take more risk.
Well, I think my hand was hurting me. There was something about how I held the racket that wasn't right. I didn't hold it tightly. I tried to be more aware of how I held the handle, but as I would go back and take my swing, the ball rarely came off the racket in that with ease, I just want to say hello back at you with my swing.
Mm-hmm.
So my arm was, I was in a little pain, to be honest with you, it was a little tight, just hanging off my body, it felt a little tight. So I think that affected my play.
But you had two clearly different types of play, one type of play that got you to be losing 5-2, and then another type of play that won at least 3 games in a row, maybe four.
We won, yeah, that's right, you did. We won 4 games in a row.
And that's still the same hand.
Right, but I know about myself that I could probably have a 2-hour warm-up, then play a game. I'm a little slow on the uptake a little bit for myself. So I need to go through an extensive warm-up. And I think what also happened, I began to have more fun. Even though we were down and we were playing at a park and there wasn't really anybody there, and I just said, can you hear the roar of the crowd? I was being playful. And through
when
that...
Once you were down.
Right. So I was having,
what was happening? But you were more serious before you were. But while you were losing, you were more serious.
Right, because my partner and I, when we play normally, we usually win. He's a much stronger partner than I am, but I add my own strengths to the game. But we usually win 6-2 or 6-3. But this man who substituted had a little more experience and was a
and he didn't have a backhand.
And he didn't have a backhand. It was wacky. It was really. What do you make of that? That he quickly switches to his left hand to have a forehand.
Nothing.
Nothing. Oh.
It's his style of play.
I know, but what would be the mental thought behind not, if you're a right-handed player, not using a backhand?
Well, we could there could be injury.
That's true.
There could be awareness that he plays better that way.
Wow, but it seems like an awful, you know, for someone like myself, I will share this with our listeners, that sometimes makes life more difficult for myself in achieving anything or accomplishing even a simple task, that even though it looked like nanoseconds that he threw the racket from his right hand to his left hand to be able to hit the ball, it seemed that he was making it difficult for himself instead of just turning and hitting. How simple was that? That's what I noticed. I thought, wow, it's so difficult. Why are you doing that? As if it was slow motion and the racket was spinning in the air waiting for it to come down and he would grab the handle and then hit the ball.
But it worked.
It did, but I just find it fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I didn't really notice it the first time, and then I thought, well, gosh, something's odd. This man didn't hit a backhand. But it was very interesting because now I'm learning about the opponent and how I can, with my partner, strategize to win the game.
Yes.
So those are important key.
And your idea is something you noticed about hitting the ball at him rather than to one side or the other makes him have to deal with two aspects. One is he's got to get out of the way, and then he also has to choose which forehand he wants to hit with.
Where to
not only move his feet, but to where to move the racket, whereas a person who plays single-handed has one less thing to do.
And I want to make it, I think, I'm not going to make it as easy for you to return the ball. I want to make it a little more challenging for you. So I've said something to you with my stroke. So now what are you going to say? How
mm-hmm.
are you going to respond to me? Don't tell me what I want to hear. Let me hear what you have to say.
Yep.
I love dead air space, don't you?
Yep.
But that's fast. It's very interesting.
Psychologically, I have no idea what it would mean unless he was on the phone with us or in person.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he was wearing a knee brace, so maybe that it has to do with an injury and inability to move. I'm not sure how old of a man he is. So there's a lot of unknowns, but that's kind of the fun part.
Yes.
Are the unknowns and. But I personally was pleased with my performance, even though the outcome wasn't a winning one. I was very happy with my performance.
And how do you do that?
How do I do that?
Yeah, I'm working with a golfer who we realized that he is a sore winner. No matter how well he plays a round of golf competitively, he is always, at least until about 4 months ago, has almost always been dissatisfied. And I started calling him a sore winner because he plays very well, very high-level competitive player. So if he shoots a 72 or 73, he could actually be at the border of depression, angry about what happened on the fifth hole.
So what, if he does win a tournament or even a hole, how does he respond? Does he berate himself?
He can. He says he has.
Well, it sounds like, I mean, I don't...
I was just going. You lost your match, even though you had a beautiful run of those four games to get back to 6-5. I mean, yeah, 6-5 in your favor, and then it seesawed back and forth, and you lost. And you're pleased with how you played. You're satisfied from the experience you had. Something in you wants to play again.
But I don't think it was always that way for me. I've had to change. I've had experiences where I wanted to change that because I've been a perfectionist and have expectations, and those two thought patterns, when I'm on the court, it doesn't make me enjoy the game. If I'm a perfectionist and have an expectation, I can never win. So the joy of playing tennis for me is not experienced.
And you learned how to have that joyful experience.
Right. As we always say, it's the journey, not so much the winning. I think I will share an experience I had with our listeners that I played with the USTA playing singles. I lost the first set, and I'm in, I guess, the second game of the second set, and I hear a pop, and I realize that something happened on my left foot. It was very painful. And I had noticed the rest of my...
I think I remember this.
My teammates, yes, they were gathering around the court, I think because I was the last match of this day, and it was hot. And I was exhausted, but I said to myself, and this is how powerful mind over matter is and how you speak to yourself, that especially in the professional arena of any sport, that you can talk to yourself in a way that you can overcome a problem if you've hurt yourself. And I did. I overcame the foot, and I realized that the opponent wasn't really aware of what happened because she never played to my disability. So long story short, I won the match. It didn't really matter that I won because my team already won
the team score.
General. Yes, but it was a personal victory. And that was so. I was so proud of myself. And
when did you play? And how long were you off the court on the disabled list?
A year. I didn't play. I couldn't play. But it was a sense of you can do it, Lauren. This is for you. It's not because everybody said to me, the other team members, during a changeover said, Lauren, you don't have to finish because we won. My game didn't count at all. But it was
no,
a personal. It was a personal victory, and I'm very. Even though the consequences were such that I couldn't play tennis for a year, it.
There was something else that you were out there to do.
Exactly.
It's not a. I thought it was about the tennis.
Yes, it's about the tennis. Well,
it's about my ego.
It's my ego. Well, you know what? We can ask these two questions to. Dr. Davis K. Brimberg, who I believe is on the line.
Hi, Lauren and Zach. Hi.
Hello, Dr. Davis.
Hello, Dr. D.
Hello.
Let me just give a little blurb about Dr. Davis K. Brimberg, Ph.D., is a licensed clinical psychologist, and Dr. Davis specializes in helping performers achieve their potential and has worked with actors, public speakers, singers, dancers, business professionals, and enjoys helping people of all ages with general psychological concerns. So welcome to the show, Dr.
Thank you. Thank you. And Lauren, as I was listening to your story, I didn't want to interrupt you, but I've been listening for a little bit. And the thing that comes to mind is that you won your inner game.
Ah, beautiful. What a nice little segue. I did. I did win my inner game.
It sounds like that's what it was about for you.
It was about my inner game, with my own struggle of usually being the phoenix rising from the ashes.
Mm.
How I place myself. So it was a personal victory, and I needed to prove something to myself that I could win, and what winning felt like, even though it didn't matter. A lot of people might have just succumbed to the pain and said, "Wow, that it's too painful for me to continue." But the pain was there, but it wasn't really there. It was a little out of the body experience on a certain level.
Mm-hmm.
Because my mind was so definite and made up about what I needed to do for myself to feel good about myself that the body just took over.
Well, it's such a strong example of how powerful the mind is and what kind of effect it has on the body.
That's true. That's true. Now, Zach, you remember we were speaking earlier, and you said we're going to ask this question to Davis. Do you remember what we were talking about?
Absolutely not.
Excellent. Good, good.
We were talking about the linking of perfectionism and procrastination.
Oh, they are very, very linked. And they're linked in all sorts of ways. In the academic realm, for example, students who procrastinate quite a bit are often very perfectionistic. And the same thing goes for things that happen athletically. A lot of people delay competition. They delay getting involved in competition, let's say, because they are so perfectionistic. They're so hard on themselves. It's a part of why they procrastinate getting out there and playing matches.
So from a psychological approach, how would you talk to your patient to help them deal with this situation?
One of the things that I talk to people about is the worst-case scenario. And I ask them point blank, okay, so what would happen if your worst-case scenario happened? Could you deal with it? And we go through whatever the various pieces are in their worst-case scenario. And for everybody, that worst-case scenario is very, very different. And
or ultimately the same.
Yes. Very different in the specifics, but
yes,
may have very, very, very similar themes. And
as an example, what would be a patient's fear? Because we were talking about playing tennis, that if you were to hit the ball, you might hit it on the rim of the racket, or it might bounce off an odd area on the center of the racket, all these little fears. So what would
or
be
how
fear?
About you get up and you double fault constantly?
Right, but from your perspective, not taking tennis out of the foray, from a psychological point of view, what would be someone's fear in performance?
Mm-hmm. It usually comes from the fear of not measuring up to other people's expectations, or the fear of not measuring up to one's own expectations. The feeling that they are a failure and that they have let themselves down, they've let other people who are important to them down, or they've let their perception of how other people see them, that they've let that down as well.
So the burden of obligation.
Yes. Yes.
Go ahead.
Please.
No, I'll go.
Go ahead.
No, you go. I'll go. Okay, you're it.
So, Zach, you were saying about the obligation.
So it becomes a large, weighted burden of obligation that the performer is carrying around with them.
Exactly.
And they want to please everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they want to please their own expectations of themselves,
mm-hmm,
which causes more perfectionism and more procrastination. So their swing or their vocal cords, if they're singers, tighten.
Or they become even more focused on themselves. One of the things that I was speaking to an attorney recently in a session who was very anxious about public speaking, about this very big court case and what was happening. And I helped him over a series of several sessions, and he got progressively more and more comfortable and actually wound up having a very, very good result in this case. But in the process, he said he came to realize that it wasn't really all about him, that what he was doing was really for the case. It was for the client. It was for the issues that he was arguing.
To learn to be an advocate.
Exactly, that he was there to be an advocate, but that it wasn't really about him.
Mm.
And a lot of performers put that kind of pressure and expectation anxiety, all of that on themselves because it feels very, very much about them. And ultimately...
So then they were dealing with narcissism-ish things?
Insecurities. I mean, we all... I'm of the opinion that we all have some level of narcissism in us.
I totally agree, that, and there's a healthy aspect to that.
Exactly. There's absolutely a healthy aspect to that narcissism.
And then if it goes too far, it becomes a negative also.
That's right.
So Zach, can you give us an example of how perhaps you would have helped this lawyer with his fear of public speaking on the court?
How would I have helped the...
How would you have addressed this issue off the couch? Or out of the office and on the court?
I would have spoken to Davis, and we would have, hopefully with the client's permission, we would discuss what's going on. Davis would say, why don't you try this to help him trust himself more, to help him realize that he is in a dialogue. It's not a monologue,
mm-hmm.
that it's not just about him,
mm-hmm.
which, and then... that he's there to share his excellence and not competing with his own vision of himself as Clarence Darrow, or his vision of himself as a cowering little boy who's scared of what the judge may say. I mean, mommy may say. And play with that on the court.
And of course, tennis, of course, is not a one-person act. It's all about how that player is able to manage what's happening between them and this other person.
Theoretically.
Theoretically, but most people don't play in.
Most people get a little too narcissistic and think it's all about them.
Mm-hmm. Right. But if their ego gets involved, then you see how the play differs than if that person is aware of their opponent and engaged in the play.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we do an exercise called bounce hit, my mentor created, and most people when asked to do bounce hit pretty much only do bounce and hit on their side of the court. Even though the exercise is described to say bounce every time you see the ball bounce and every time you see the ball hit the strings or the racket, which would be on both sides, but most people are more self-involved, and the attorney might be one of those before working with Davis, because he's scared, and he's more worried about what his performance is rather than the relationship, and forgetting that the earliest moment he can see the ball, the better for him. The more he can hear his client's pain or frustration, the more clear he can be with his next shot.
Well, this is such a popular topic that I believe we have another caller on the line. So let's check in and see who's joining this wonderful conversation.
How are you, Davis?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great.
You know, I was just also thinking about what
Hello,
you...
Hello, you're on the line with Dr. Davis K. Bringberg and Zach.
Am I on?
You're
yes,
on.
You are.
Hello.
Hi, my name's Matt.
Hi, Matt.
Oh, hi, Matt.
Hi.
Is it the Matt that I know?
This is the Matt you know. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Matt. Matt is a dear friend, a yoga buddy, and a fabulous actor. And I had mentioned to Matt today that we were having this very interesting show with Zach, the tennis guru and a psychologist. So, Matt, you have a question?
Well, I've just been listening, and it's been fascinating for me as an actor, and I guess my question would be, you know, I've dealt with auditioning for many years and, you know, kind of mostly can keep my nerves in check, but, you know, when I am going for something larger, like let's say I'm going for, you know, a big series or something, I can still feel my nerves start to bubble up when I get in that room, and I was maybe... just wondering if there was some practical advice that Dr. Davis could give that might help me, like, in that particular situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a few things that come to mind. One is, the importance of practicing before the actual event. You know, as soon as you know when the audition is coming up, in your apartment or your house, wherever, start practicing out loud, introducing yourself to this imaginary casting agent, and really just talking the whole thing out loud as much as you can. That's one piece of practical advice, is to literally say it all out loud. And the other thing that I would really strongly urge you to do is to get excited about it. You're nervous about something because you care so much about it, because it's important to you, because this is your dream, because this is your chance to really do something that you love so much. This is a fantastic opportunity. And so the fact that you're nervous is a sign of just how important it is. And I think you...
Something that you guys touched on, which I think is very, very important, and what helps me a lot is realizing that I am not the doer. You know, I am only the instrument for, you know, whatever you want to call it, the divine energy, God, to flow through me. And so when I realize, hey, I'm not the doer, it helps really relax me. You know, as long as I can get out of my own way, and sometimes I get in my own way and I block that flowing, you know, but if I can remain kind of a pure instrument, that's when the magic can happen, and that's when, you know, you're really this you feel like you're this vessel. And also, one other thing is, you know, if I don't get the part, you know, like, even though I know I did my best, you know, I can just look and say, hey, that wasn't my part, you know, and that wasn't meant to be, and I know that, you know, a part that is supposed to be mine is coming.
Right, and statistically, let's face it, the odds are never in an actor's favor. Statistically,
yeah.
it doesn't matter how extraordinarily talented the actor is or even as successful as they are. You know, the odds are not in the actor's favor, and so it's even more important to love what you do, getting the part or not getting the part, to really embrace the audition as a chance to enjoy yourself and to do your best, because, you know, there isn't much that the actor can do to control the outcome, which is very, very difficult. It is literally a crazy industry.
It certainly is.
Because
Zach,
it's not...
Do you have any thoughts about Matt's question?
No, I think we're all on the same track. One of the things I try to remind the actors is that the fun of the opportunity to do their craft is crucial, and to remember that the goal ultimately is, as sort of Davis was saying, the odds of getting any part is so little, you may as well have fun doing it and not take it so seriously. And to be playful with the process. My wife would say is they don't know what they want anyway. If they're still auditioning, they have
it's
no
true.
Idea.
They don't know what they want.
and to go in there and to have the courage to express how you see this character you developed at home while practicing is going to show herself or himself.
Right.
And
yeah,
I
just
think,
like you said, Matt, about not getting in your own way, I think the essence of fun allows oneself to be playful and not get in your own way, so you can be a truer sense of who you are. And when you are yourself, you are more likely to enjoy what you're doing and
be comfortable in your own shoes.
Be comfortable in your own shoes.
Yes,
and beautiful.
And I'm going to add it, and to love yourself.
Yes, absolutely.
Because the more comfortable you are, the more you're able to enjoy, and the more you're able to really, really love who you are.
Well, let's face it, that's what the show is about. It's called How to Be Comfortable in Your Own Shoes, but in essence, it's how to love yourself. And from that perspective, enjoyment can be found in most anything you do.
Absolutely. And, you know, they call it playing a part because you are literally supposed to be playful.
Uh-huh.
And I think that for a lot of actors, there's, you know, there's so much pressure and stress and all of that. It's easy for people to forget to bring the playfulness to their craft.
One of my clients is a writer, and he's auditioning for parts to get a writing job. And his agent asked him to call me to take some tennis lessons before his interviews. And I said, show me how you sit at the interview. And he sat, it almost like he fell backward on the court.
Mm.
And I said, well, why don't you hit the next 25, 30 balls sitting on the edge of the chair? Just sit on the edge of the chair and hit the ball. And it put all his weight forward into the center of the room. It looked like he was more invested. I asked him if he wanted the part, the job, the writing job, and he said, yes. I'm going, if you're sitting back in that couch, no one's going to ever know. He says, well, I don't really want them to know too much. I said, well, then you probably won't get it if you're not engaged and willing to look like a fool.
Willing to really risk.
Yes.
But there, and, you know what, there really is no risk because you don't have it anyway. There's no, the risk is being you, and that's what we all have fear in doing, is being ourselves.
The ultimate risk is that.
That's the ultimate risk.
And Matt has to face that every audition.
That's why actors are some of the most courageous people out there, because they're constantly facing the possibility of rejection, constantly. Just a part of their daily struggle. Most people do everything they can to avoid having to deal rejection, to deal with rejection. Actors actually chase it. they actually are in a profession which by definition forces them to constantly face the possibility of rejection.
When's your next audition?
Matt, what do you love most about being an actor?
What's that?
What do you love most about being an actor?
I love when I have the opportunity to serve. You know, I look at acting as serving. You know, I think it's a very important service to humanity. You know, that's why people love the movies so much and go to see plays, because they can have that cathartic experience where they remember who they really are. So it really helps me. You know, I'm not in it for, you know, fame or money, or I would have quit a long time ago. You know, I look at it as a way to serve, you know, and I, you know, with that frame of mind, it just helps me keep plugging along, because when I do get those parts and you're really able to move people and that magic happens, then you're like, oh, it's just all been worth it.
Well, Matt, I want to thank you for calling in. This was just, you added
so
much joy to the pie today.
Absolutely. And thank you.
Thank you. And I want to thank all our guests. Davis, I want you to give out a number where people can contact you. We have a minute left.
I need to say one thing about Davis. She has a charity event Sunday, June 27th at 2 p.m. Look her up online.
Yes. Cat Haven. It's fantastic.
Cat Haven, CATHAVEN.com.
And it's www.drdaviskbrimberg.com, all one word. Dr. Davis, DAVISK, as in kitten, Brimberg, BRIMBERG, .com. And Zach, how can people get in touch with you?
TennisDiary.com, TennisDiary.com. Matt, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us.
How can agents get in touch with you, Matt?
Look me up on IMDb.
Okay.
Beautiful.
Thank you so much, Lauren and Zach and Matt. It's been great.
It was great. We didn't get to talk about a possible project that Davis and Zach will be doing in the future. So perhaps at another session of How to Be Comfortable in Your Own Shoes, we can do that. So I'd like to once again thank Dr. Davis K. Brimberg, Zach Kleiman, for joining me today. And please join me next time for another wild and crazy journey in someone else's shoes, as my mystery guest will be. Ha ha ha. This is Lauren Leibowitz, and thank you again for joining me and listening to How to Be Comfortable in Your Own Shoes. We'll see you next time, and I look forward to helping you find comfort in your own shoes. Bye.
Bye, Lauren.
Bye.
Bye.